Let me introduce our vice president and moderator today, Bonnie Brewer. She's also the program chair, and she will introduce the speakers, and she'll moderate the session. Bonnie? Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming today. Our panel today, it should be familiar to everyone. This is our annual May meeting with a recap of the General Assembly session. We have invited all of our current representatives. Three have been able to be here with us: Cree Deeds, Steve Landis, and David Toscano. Cree Deeds is the Democratic senator from the 25th District since 2001, after previously serving in the House. Steve Landis is the 25th District delegate, retiring after 12 years. 24 years. Well, you don't look that old. David Toscano is retiring after 7 terms. Did I get that right?
I think so, yep.
Yeah. And from 2011 to 2018, he was the House Democratic leader. So we're just going to turn this over to the three men that are here. It seems to work very well. They have plenty to tell us, and if you remember, we will ask them questions when they finish speaking. So, Steve, you weren't here last year, so I'm going to make the executive decision and let you go first.
Well, first of all, let me thank you for that introduction, and thank the senior statesmen and women for inviting us once again. Always appreciate the opportunity, and I don't make it every year, but I try to make it every other year if I can't make it every year. So I owed you one, so that's why I'm here. As it was mentioned, I am not running for re-election this year, so I'm pursuing other opportunities in Augusta County. But I guess David and I are has-beens at this point, we look forward to your questions as well. And it's always good to be with Cree. Having served, he had opportunity to serve in the House of Delegates and knows that body and knows the Senate obviously very well. Let me talk a little bit about what I think were the important issues of the General Assembly, and then hit on some specific pieces of legislation that I had the privilege of shepherding through both the House and Senate. First and foremost, the most important thing that we did this year, I think, which is, I say this every year that I'm here, is dealing with the biennial budget. And we did adopt amendments to the biennial budget. We did some significant things, I think, related to K-12. We're able to include about $85.7 million for a 5% teacher pay raise. We were able to also provide about $57 million to freeze tuition rate increases for our institutions of higher learning, only if they, the institutions obviously receive those funds, only if they were to actually freeze their tuition. And most of the institutions seem to be taking advantage of that and doing that, so I thought that was a good thing. We were able to also provide about $12 million for school resource officers, among a lot of aspects of what we were able to do related to school safety. In addition to those things in the budget, we also deposited about $565.5 million in our revenue reserve, and that's our savings account in case the economy were to decline at some point in time, and that allows us to plan so that we don't have to make immediate cuts in balancing our budget, and that's a good thing for both the local governments and the state government. When I mentioned the teacher pay raise, the one caveat I need to mention is that localities will have some flexibility with that, in that if they cannot provide the full 5%, they can do a lesser amount. But as you all recall from previous meetings, probably the important thing to remember with education funding is that the state provides about 50% and the local governments provide about 50%. So when we're talking about a 5% raise, the state's providing about 2.5%, and localities then would do the like amount. We also, and I think this was significant, were able to pass a nearly $1 billion tax relief package to coincide with what happened in Washington related to the federal tax adjustments that they made. And I think for most families, they're going to see nearly $400 in direct tax relief and over the next two years, and that will include about $220 in tax rebates this year. So that's a good thing. Let me real quickly talk about some of the bills that I was involved in, and then let Cree and David have a chance as well. One of the things that JLARC studied, and I have the chance and the opportunity to serve on JLARC, and I'm also the vice chairman for the remainder of this year, we were able to get through House Bill 1611 that the governor signed that will basically set for the Virginia College Savings Plans a pricing reserve that will allow them to go up to 110%, but start at about 105%. JLARC did a study, and right now the College Savings Plan has a reserve about 130%, and the problem with that is they don't need quite that much to make sure they're covering their contract costs. And by doing this in the legislation, most contracts for the families that purchase those will be able to save about $3,000 a year. So we think that will be significant. We also had House Bill 1729 that the governor signed that will set the school counselor work ratio at 80% in working with students and counseling them and dealing with behavioral health issues and the like, and 20% of their time could be other things like administrative work. We found over the last year with the Select Committee on School Safety that many school counselors were actually spending most of their time not counseling students. So one of the things that we think that will be a good reform and help address student emotional and behavioral health issues is that they will spend more time working with students and actually counseling them. We also changed the name from school guidance counselors to school counselors to better reflect their actual role and responsibility. And we also started the path down trying to make sure we're reaching a goal of about one counselor per 250 students. So that will be a good thing. Now, the funding is in the budget for this year and next year, but then we'll have to continue that, or the General Assembly will have to continue that going forward. One of the other things that I had was House Bill 2337, which will allow for more public comment and transparency for tuition and fee increases by boards of visitors. In other words, before those actions are taken by the board, the public, students, and parents will have a chance to comment on those tuition rates and those fees so that they're getting direct public input before they make those determinations. And then last but not least, we were able to pass House Bill 2662, which will, for the first time, set the course for the Board of Education, the department, to start looking for ways for a actual requirement for graduation for what work, community service, or other experiences as part of the high school redesign will entail. And more importantly, how students will be able to utilize that in either making a presentation or some kind of portfolio so that they can show what that experience that they'll have an opportunity the last 2 years of high school with the rollback of the standards of learning test, so that they'll have an internship, a mentorship, apprenticeship, and be able to take advantage for those children that are going in higher education, more AP and dual enrollment classes. But we want all students to have some kind of experience from the standpoint of actually working or learning what they may want to do upon graduation from high school. So the board's going to look at that and come back next year and say what that might look like and what kind of graduation requirement could be tied to that for all schools and all students. So with that, let me stop there and see what my colleagues have to say.
Well, I will jump in because David's got a PowerPoint and he will fill in all the blanks where he'll correct all our errors. Yeah. Let me just say in the first, I'm going to continue to work at this, but I'm going to miss Steve and I'm going to miss David. Yeah, I've known both of them for an awful long time, and they both been public servants that you should be proud of. That we don't always agree. We disagree a lot, actually. But we try to work together to carry out our vision for the people we represent. And Steve and David are two of the good ones. And I'm, I hope we appreciate what we had. This was a short session. It lasted 47 days, one day extra. Because we had some things we just didn't agree on, or we didn't get finished until right at the end. But I just want to highlight three or four things that did get done that I think are going to make a difference in the life of some Virginians. Number one, as Steve pointed out, it's a good budget year. We had a big surplus. Part of that was because of the changes in the federal tax law wrought by the tax bill in 2017. Part of that's because the economy's going good. Part of that is because the Supreme Court said we could tax internet sales. There was a lot of tax surplus, and some of that money is one-time money. It doesn't make any sense to build that into the baseline because it's not going to be there next year. And so you're going to be getting checks in October, right before the election, by the way. $110 a taxpayer for a single taxpayer, $220 for a married couple. So that's number one. Number two, we're going to take some of that money back. Interstate 81 carries about 41% of the truck traffic in Virginia. It's a highway that's failed. Anybody that travels that road very much knows that it's not reliable and it's not safe. There are, I think, 45 accidents on it a year that we have backups of more than 4 hours. So when you're traveling through that bucolic Shenandoah Valley and all of a sudden you feel like you're in Fairfax, it's not a rare occurrence. So this year we got a bill passed that funds about $2.2 billion worth of improvements over that road over the next 20 years. Because nothing is free. We have to pay for that. We're paying for it through the bulk of the money is going to come with additional taxes and additional fees on trucks. And that was agreed to by the truckers. But the taxes in the planning districts that touch 81, where I live, for example, in Bath County, we'll see our gas tax go up about 6.7 cents a gallon, July 1. That's number two. Number three, for years, we've talked about redistricting reform. This year, the General Assembly passed a constitutional amendment for the first time. Both houses passed a constitutional amendment that reforms redistricting. It'll have to pass next year's General Assembly session, then be approved by the voters in the fall, and then it'll become part of the law for the next time the districts are drawn, 2021. We'll have time to talk about that during this session and also during the next year, because the General Assembly will have to approve it in exactly the same form in the next year. And the fourth thing that I think is really important that happened is that the General Assembly funded bond funding, reconstruction of Central State Hospital. Anybody who's been to Western State Hospital or Eastern State, you see state-of-the-art facilities. Central State is a reminder of the darkest days of segregation, in my view. And it's more of a one flew over the cuckoo's nest type hospital. It's difficult enough to recruit professionals to work in that sort of environment. But when you have an environment where people aren't going to get well, and physically it just was a dangerous place, it was a necessary step for us to do it, to go forward, and it's going to be built over about 5 years. But it's important, that hospital is important because it not only has our forensic unit where people that are being evaluated and have committed the worst or are alleged to have committed the worst sort of offenses are held. It's also the oldest psychiatric facility for African Americans in the country. It's part of our history, and it was important that we take that step. So those are four significant things that happened, I think, that happened this short session. Take it away, David.
So thank you very much for having us again. I'm going to miss these guys. I won't totally miss them because I'm sure I'm going to see them. So that's good. But it's been a pleasure working with them for the last 14 years. And it's been a pleasure coming here, I think, for each of those 14 years. I don't know who gave us this logo, but now I think we have to change it, right? Isn't it? You got to put, don't you have to put women in there, right?
No.
No? Okay. Well, whatever. I'll leave that to you. I will come back again and talk anytime you want me to talk. I'm doing a little writing now, and part of my writing is an exposition about why states matter. You know, we focus so much on the federal government and all of the machinations in Washington, we forget that states are critically important to how this country runs, and increasingly important as Washington continues to bog down in gridlock, and more of the things that people consider significant are being taken over by the states for total control. And we've had total control of various things important, from voting rights to education to criminal justice, for a long, long time. So have me back. But I always come, as you know, with a PowerPoint, so I'm gonna play the PowerPoint, because I forget everything I'm gonna say unless I can look at. Okay, that's me. Of course, you know the state of play in Virginia now. We have Democrats who occupy all these statewide elected offices, and of course, in the General Assembly 2 years ago, it looked like this, where in the House, the Republicans had the massive majority, and the Senate was very close. There was an election in 17, and it changed. And that changed everything. The power of 49 was alive and well in the House of Delegates. And there's another election this year, so we'll see what happens with that. I will start by talking about a few of the things that are kind of funny that go under the radar, but I think you may be interested in these. So first of all, we did pass a law, this is really significant for me, that allows people actually to advertise our happy hour information. You know, I think a lot of folks didn't know that you couldn't do this now, but I'm sure that now July 1 will roll around and you're going to start to see all kinds of ads for happy hours. And for those of us who like happy hours and try to find the best bargains and where to go, we're going to be looking for those ads. So don't say your state government is not working for you. Now, you've heard of the word barnacle. But I don't know that you've ever heard of the word barnacle on cars, which is a way you can essentially immobilize a vehicle if they haven't paid their traffic fine. So I don't know whether we'll see these barnacles in Charlottesville, but watch out for them, because now they can use barnacles to immobilize a car. So watch for that. Now, of course, every year we have our hunting bills. And this is one that authorizes the killing of a nuisance species on private property by the owner of such property from a stationary vehicle.
I voted against that. And I was maybe the only one person to vote against.
And you're in a rural area.
I am.
I don't know. But so yeah, be careful for these guys out there with the guns shooting from a stationary vehicle. For those of you who like Corvettes, sadly, you didn't get permission to allow just the use of a single plate as opposed to a double plate. Now, Steve will remember this because this got a lot of debate on the House floor, right? And then it went down in flames on the House floor, which usually doesn't occur. Usually these bills are defeated in committee and subcommittee. But this was a fun one that we got defeated on the House floor. The patron is now not coming back to the General Assembly. I'm sure it has nothing to do with this bill, but it was
this bill.
Fun.
I forget.
Riley Ingram.
Riley. Oh, yeah.
And for those who like to see advertising on school buses, well, there's limited advertising on school buses. I don't know who of you will be interested in that, But that passed the House, but didn't pass the Senate. So it shows you the Senate may. Did you vote for this?
I'm not on that committee.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't have voted for it.
So, you know, you got to watch these bills. This bill will be back. Plaster school buses with ads. Budget challenges we've already talked about. Huge implications. The federal tax cut didn't, I guess, I didn't, maybe they didn't think about what was going to happen in Virginia. But what was going to happen in Virginia as a result of the federal tax cut, if we didn't do anything, Virginians are going to pay a lot more in taxes. And so we did something, and that included the rebates. Some of the money was held back into the taxpayer, so-called taxpayer relief fund, which is a fund that's out there, in theory, as Steve said, that we could use in bad times or that we will appropriate later on, which is probably the more likely thing that will happen with that fund. So we'll see what happens with that. And this is what we did with it. Now, of course, there was some extra money. So when we got to the so-called reconvened session, which is the session we get together about a month after the session formally ends to consider the governor's recommended changes in the budget, we were able to put some money back in because there was some extra money. Included in that was some money for the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which a lot of people around here are very interested in. Of course, we had the largest one-time pay increase for teachers. We talked about that. More money for school counselors. Some other things that passed. Coal ash remediation. This is a big thing. We don't have a lot of ponds in our area where these debris have been kept. But we're going to clean this up over time. You will experience some increase in your electricity, your utility bill as a result, but it's for the sake of the environment, so we passed that. One of the bills, this was a big bill. This was having to do with allowing people to drive even though their license has been suspended for fines and costs, people being unable to pay their fines and costs, therefore not be able to have a license and therefore not being able to get to work or get their kids to school. The governor sent down an amendment to the budget, and that got passed, so people will be able to drive. Now, it's not formally in the law, we may have to amend the law next year, but it is in the budget because there was a budgetary impact of this. So that's going to happen July 1. 627,000 people. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people will be affected by this.
These aren't necessarily people that have done anything wrong except not being able to pay their fine.
Yeah, they could be like a traffic offense that they didn't pay a fine for.
Yeah.
Could be something like that. We're not letting people out of jail in order to drive cars. That's not what's happening. I-81, we talked about here briefly. I had a bill that is going to cut down on financial exploitation. It gives some banks some more flexibility for turning down the effort for somebody to invade another person's account who is elderly and can be taken advantage of, which is, I think, an increasing problem in our society. So hopefully this bill will help some things. Tax conformity bill we talked about, and nurse practitioners got a little break with us, too. So these are things that didn't pass. The Equal Rights Amendment, try as we did, we couldn't get that passed. I guess the Senate passed it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Right. There was an effort to repeal the right to work statute that didn't pass. Of course, the Confederate statutes, that was my bill. I didn't get out of subcommittee. That was the one that would have allowed localities to control the erection and maintenance of Confederate statues in public places. Not all war memorials, just Confederate statues. The Green New Deal was proposed, but it was not passed by the House. No gun reform legislation whatsoever was passed. And an effort to increase the minimum wage failed in the House as well. The governor was active in vetoing legislation. What's 11? I don't know how many vetoes, but they were all sustained. There was a bill in the House that would have prohibited the Commonwealth from joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative without an affirmative vote of 2/3 of both bodies, and that was vetoed by the governor and sustained. various forms of what they call skinny health insurance plans were vetoed by the governor. These are plans where you could buy a cheaper plan, cheaper health care, but you might not have everything covered that you may need to have covered. And there was a concealed weapons permit bill that was vetoed by the governor. We're going to have continuing challenges in 2020 involving the ACA and efforts to undermine the ACA at the federal level and what it means for state insurance markets. And we're going to have some things with distracted driving that still need to be done. We had a bill that almost got passed. It got hung up with the definition of in his hand and what that means. And grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. There's a, we get into these debates on the House floor and people bring up grandma and how was she use her phone and what does that mean for grandma? You don't want to know about it. Of course, there was movement on redistricting reform. It wasn't exactly the bill that I would have favored, but it did pass. The issue, of course, is will it pass again? Because it has to pass in exactly the same form. And you've got a big election coming up this fall where there are a lot of House seats up for grabs and all the Senate seats as well. And you could see a very different composition in the General Assembly in January. Will they like this plan or not? I don't know. We'll see. If they don't, we will go towards right back to the partisan redistricting arrangement we have used in the past. Of course, I always leave you with the redistricting. Next up, June 11th, there's a primary, one for the seat, the 57th, which I presently occupy.
Who are you voting for?
I'm going to tell you in a couple weeks. You just wait, you just watch, and you can read what I say, and then figure out what you want to do. I'm voting for you. You're running for office, aren't you?
I am, but you've got to come over to Augusta County.
That'd be fraud. But since there's no fraud in Virginia, I'm not going to engage in fraud by coming over and voting for you. But I will support you in that election. You can write that down. November 6th, of course, Steve is up for the clerkship in Augusta County, and Cree is up, and I'll just be pontificating. So I encourage you to listen to the pontificating, and I've got 6 months left. We got a budget to prepare. I still have a lot of gas in the tank, and I intend to use that gas to help you in the last 6-7 months. So thank you very much.
Okay. So as you recall, now the audience will speak at you. Questions? All right. Wait for the microphone. And who's? Are you the only one with a mic, John? All right. Madison, Rich gets to, because he's the president. Yes, Rich.
I may have missed it, David, but you talked about or on the screen the gender neutral for a contraceptive and Bill 1979. I didn't hear what it was.
Okay, so we have this, we have a surrogacy procedure in Virginia, and it has to be updated to make it easier for people to be able to have, well, to be able to essentially adopt children through a surrogacy process. And that's what that bill was about. It was to make it easier for people to bring kids into their lives. Now, of course, it's always very controversial because some of the people who are having these children brought into their lives are same sex, and that gets some people upset in the General Assembly. This bill passed on pretty hefty majority, so it wasn't as controversial as we would have thought several years ago. You know, the attitudes have changed a lot. But that's what that bill did.
In an election year, it's tougher. I mean, the chief advocates for this bill were members of former Governor Allen's cabinet. And so there were bipartisan folks in favor of the bill, and there were but an election year means that people are very squeamish about voting for this sort of legislation. And so it was somewhat questionable in the House Courts Committee. But, you know, we managed to fight off the amendments and get it passed.
Thank you. Could you all speak to the Amazon deal? What was given to them in tax breaks and what you see long term, the impact of that on your state revenue?
And Steve probably has the numbers down a little more specific. The as I recall, you know, here's the problem with Northern Virginia. No state is more dependent on federal spending than Virginia. No state is more dependent on federal spending than Virginia. And Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads are our cash cows, and they are totally federally dependent. So it's important that we do everything we can to diversify our economy. These are $150,000 a year jobs that are coming in. We're not paying anything until the jobs are created. And the bulk of what we're paying is to create we're investing in Virginia Tech and George Mason and our other institutions of higher learning to create these engineering jobs and computer science jobs that are going to benefit more than just Amazon. But Steve probably has more specific about what the numbers were than I do.
And Creed's exactly right. We are not providing any of the incentives until the jobs are started to come online. Anything different than we've pretty much done with other economic incentive packages, and their pieces and parts, both the locality and the state are providing. The one thing that is different, as Cree mentioned, is we are talking about ramping up programs that actually UVA, Tech, and other institutions will be involved in, so that the individuals that they're looking for to be employed will be able to come from in-state through our higher educational programs. The compensation for the average paying job is about $150,000 a year, which is significantly more than the average paying job for most places. The company's going to be investing $2.5 billion in Virginia, related to the headquarters, and we're only getting really half of the original, you know, kind of headquarters. The other half was supposedly going to go to New York, but they screwed up. So, so we may see even more from the standpoint of the future. The other thing that I think our estimate is that Virginia from day one will produce a more than 6-to-1 return in the investment we're going to be making over 20 years, those incentives I mentioned. And the project supposedly is estimated to produce about $3.2 billion in general fund revenue, in other words, tax dollars that the state will receive in the future. And probably the most significant thing about having Amazon in the state from the standpoint of those individuals that are going to be in the headquarters and that will be in Virginia and in Maryland and D.C. is just the fact that what those kinds of jobs and that company can bring to Virginia, either additional expansion for operations in Virginia, just the nature of their business and kind of the cutting edge that they are in the marketplace, and we think that all will benefit Virginia. It also probably will help us get other companies like Apple and other institutions or organizations that are kind of in that same vein.
Do you have the figure? I mean, we don't pay anything yet. We don't pay any money until the jobs are created.
There are a couple things that anytime you consider these subsidy issues, you got to be really careful. All states are doing it. We're all competing with each other, and that's probably not the best thing we should be doing, because there's kind of becomes a race to give people more and more and more. So you really have to cost it out and figure out if it is in the best interest of the Commonwealth or the state before you extend these subsidies. So when you look at this deal, you say, well, there's a couple of really good things in this. One is, this is going to be a net positive revenue generator from day one. mainly because they're going to build it out before they employ people, and then they're only going to get the subsidy when they employ the people. So we're bringing in tax revenue right from the get-go, and they're going to get something, but it's going to be later on. And then we still are net ahead, even when they have these jobs there. Secondly, it was a good excuse for us to invest in infrastructure when we should have been doing it anyway. So there's a lot of transportation improvements that are being done in Northern Virginia, and that includes multimodal roads, et cetera. And there's major investment in higher education, which is going to pay benefits not just for Amazon, but for the entire Commonwealth. So those are really good things. And as Steve said, it's probably going to bring other companies right to Virginia, and that's also going to help us with our bottom line. So all of these things play a role, and even though there's been some consternation about what is the impact on housing issues in Northern Virginia, and I think we all have to be mindful of that, they are doing things to mitigate that issue, and we always have to keep that in mind anytime we relocate a big operation like we're doing with Amazon to Virginia.
What we saw when sequestration hit us several years ago was that the jobs were coming back into the Northern Virginia economy, but $160,000 a year jobs were being replaced by $100,000 a year jobs. And that was having a significant impact down the road on our revenue streams. And so we have to find ways to diversify the economy. The incentives are what everybody's doing. If you're going to play the game, you got to play the game with everybody else. It doesn't have an impact on this year, this budget, but it will have an impact on future budgets. And I was hoping Steve had, as I recall, it's like $300 or $400 million, but it's not not out of line with what we're getting back.
Bonnie, I hope you understand. I have a client. I have to leave about 20 of two.
Very little about how roads are funded in Virginia, and I do not understand when you say the businesses along I-64 are going to have to pay a tax to do that.
Not the businesses, but everybody that lives on the.
But why don't we in the whole state pay to improve?
Here's the thing. In 2013, we passed the transportation plan that basically balkanized Virginia. The thing that really made sense that survives the Byrd administration from the 20s was the creation of the Virginia Department of Highways, funded by a 3-cent gas tax. It bound us all together. It meant that roads in Cumberland County and Page County and Highland County and Bland County were going to be built to the same standards as the rest of Virginia. In 2013, we had a problem, and people in our part of the state didn't want to pay. And so we forced Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads to pay for their problems, to raise the money to build the roads in those regions. We washed our hands of their problems, but our penny wise, pound foolish. Okay, we can't fix our problems without Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, and because we've already excluded them from our problems, we have to pay. And so the people in the planning districts along 81 are going to have to pay about an average of 6.7% increase to fund $2.2 billion in road improvements on 81 over the next 20 years.
Now, the one good thing about the plan, and Cree mentioned this, is the diesel and the truck registration fee increases is more statewide.
That's right.
So all interstates will benefit from that because we'll be collecting that on all trucks traveling all interstates, and it's just based on the road miles that they travel on the interstate highway. So Interstate 81, because it has heavy truck traffic, is going to benefit the most, but 95, 66, 64, all of them will get some money towards improvements and maintaining. So that is more of a statewide piece.
This is a conversation that in the long term we really need to have, because by the time these road improvements are built on 81, the gas tax is going to be obsolete. Our vehicles are becoming more efficient, and we're going to have more electric vehicles on the highway. We're going to have to figure out another way to fund transportation, to fund highway improvements, than just a gas tax.
And we'll probably need to go at some point to some kind of miles traveled fee, because, you know, more electric vehicles and such, and they don't pay those taxes. But it's interesting, the politics of all this, because back in 2013, Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads were, quote, allowed to solve their problems by raising their own taxes. And folks up and down the valley who didn't perceive as much of a problem outside of 81 because they didn't have a lot of traffic on their own local roads, they're saying, why should we pay more money? You know, and so you can understand the logic, except for the notion that we are all one commonwealth, we all share in this. And so this year, of course, those folks in the valley, you know, they said, we need a solution, and yet some of them didn't want to pay for it. And ironically, it's the delegates and senators in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads who make the difference in this bill that benefit folks in the valley. And so it's a fascinating political story, and, you know, sometime we could spend a little more time discussing it.
Recognizing that the Amazon deal might well be a pretty good deal for the state, particularly compared to what other states have done in those situations. Was there any discussion, however, about the cost to the localities or the locality in this case? Because, you know, the studies are pretty clear that show unless you bring more than 70% of the new jobs or hire more than 70% of the new positions from within, that is, you bring in new people, that the costs associated with those are always going to outpace the new revenue that you come in, that comes in on the local level. So, you know, I was a little bit chagrined when I saw discussion after discussion about net benefits or et cetera, ignoring that issue. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was there any discussion about that that I missed?
Arlington County specifically and Alexander were the two localities, I think, that are being impacted the most. And there was a lot of discussion. One of the things that we do statewide for economic development incentives is we make sure the locality buys into the leadership, buys into the notion that there's going to be some impact. You know, there's the good, but as you mentioned, there's also the negative impact. In this case, it's going to be housing. But not every single individual of those new employees or existing employees is going to live in those localities. So Fairfax is going to be impacted, Maryland, D.C. As well. But that is one thing that we consider. And I serve on the Major Employment and Investment Commission, which looks at these projects before they go to the General Assembly, just to say, you know, we've kind of crossed all our T's and dotted our I's. And one of the things we always ask is, what is the locality putting forward to bring this incentive here? And if they don't, we usually don't move forward. So those localities bought into the notion that the good is going to outweigh the bad from the standpoint of the impact. Now, as David said, we're providing significant funding for transportation projects to speed those up, to help with both road and, more importantly, rail assistance for commuter travel and the like. And then the significant higher education investment too, but it also means there's going to be an additional Virginia Tech campus up in Northern Virginia, which obviously is going to have an impact as well. But again, the localities decided that it was going to be more to their benefit than to their detriment at this point.
You know, David, at your point is really well taken, and especially as it applies to here, as we think about ways we want to recruit business into our area. I was somewhat surprised that Arlington and Alexandria didn't make more of an issue of this. I think that the reason for that was that county and city leadership was involved in the discussions on Amazon very early, and they had a lot of input into the plan that eventually got developed. Now, here are two jurisdictions that are probably the most progressive in the Commonwealth, and certainly more sensitive to the notion of affordable housing. So when they stepped up and said, this is okay with us, a lot of us took note of that and said, well, you know, it sounds that way. Even with the challenges, they're all right, so we're okay. I would be interested in having your article about the 70%, because I've always wondered what the number actually was. You know, if you don't grow your own employees and you bring in a big business, it can be incredibly disruptive to the housing marketplace. And that's the worry I would have for up there.
In many cases, the educational system is the impact you see the most.
Yeah, if they don't have kids. Yeah. If they have kids. If they don't have kids.
Yeah.
As Steve and David point out, if the localities haven't signed off on a project like this, it doesn't rise to the level where we even do a lot of discussing of it. I mean, so they were involved early on, and they were discussing it. The bigger issue is one of housing, and affordable housing is a huge issue here. It's going to be a huge issue. It's already a huge issue in Arlington and Alexandria, and this is still going to be a really tough part that hasn't been solved.
I want to thank all three of you for coming again and again and again. I've had the opportunity to vote for David when I lived in the city and then when I moved to the county, and it's always been worthwhile to do that.
Thank you.
I would also like to keep you all to keep in mind, since I have a sister who lives in Maryland and teaches at Nova, that Northern Virginia is not the only beneficiary of this Amazon project.
Gun control issues, I don't know what the real point was, but I remember when one gun a month was the rule, and now I'm a gun fancier, I belong to Rifle Club, and inadvertently I have to belong to NRA, even though I despise that organization. But what was wrong with one gun a month? No way in the world I would ever buy one gun a month. That's one question. And the second one is, What is the nature of this bill that we're going to vote on relating to avoiding gerrymandering? What's in that? I'd like to know what that whole idea is.
I'll take the one gun a month first, okay?
Yeah.
That bill was introduced in the General Assembly this session. It was introduced in sessions past. It always gets assigned to a very small, I'm talking about in the House, it gets assigned to a very small subcommittee of the committee called Militia, Police, and Public Safety, which is pretty much stocked with NRA supporters, and they never get it out of subcommittee. And so that's what happens to that bill. Now, you know, whether that works as well as universal background checks, I think in some ways, I think universal background checks is a better way to go than one gun a month, although if you think about in the time between when Wilder got one gun a month adopted and when it was repealed, somebody could have bought 240 guns. I mean, there was a lot of guns they could have bought. So you wonder, maybe it should be like two guns a month or something. I don't know. But yeah, that maybe it'll be different if the Democrats take over. I don't know. We'll see. You might want to talk about, because did you start the bill with the redistricting?
Well, let me about the guns first off. One gun a month didn't apply to people who had concealed carry permits. It applied to about maybe 15-20% of the population. And it wasn't one gun a month. It was one handgun a month. You could buy all the rifles you wanted to, or all the Uzis you wanted to. The problem is, in this country and in Virginia, we do not have mature discussions about guns. We are in our camps, our tribes, of pro-Second Amendment, anti-Second Amendment, and we haven't come together to say we've got a problem, it affects all of us, and we need to figure it out. Until we do that, we're always going to be in our tribes. Now we've got to have that mature discussion about guns, in my view, and we just haven't had it yet. What this redistricting bill is not perfect, but it sets up this commission that's made up of legislators and people who are selected by the various heads of the two political parties that come up with a bill. And the bill goes back to the General Assembly where it has to be voted up or down. So that the bill itself, the redistricting, is not done by the General Assembly. It's done by these committees. These committees have General Assembly members, but they've got other members too, of members of the general citizenry. It's not the bill that my view is, as long as people like me or Steve or David are drawing the lines, there's going to be a built-in conflict of interest because we're going to run in the districts, right? We want districts that favor us. And so my view was just set it up outside of the legislature. That's what I would change the Constitution and do. That's not what passed, but what you can't let the good be the perfect of the enemy, in my view. So this is still a step forward. It passed this past session. As David pointed out, the General Assembly could have a very different character next year. Whether it passes or not is anybody's guess. And if it doesn't pass next time, you're probably another 10 years before you deal with it. If it passes next year, it'll be the law. Assuming that it passes a referendum next fall, it'll be the law of the next redistricting in 2021.
My question has to do with the perennial question of whether growth pays for itself.
Whether roads pay for themselves?
Does growth pay for itself? And it involves questions of what local governments can, quote, either exact or negotiate with private developers to pay for some of the associated costs that related to their developments. And it's a big issue here in Charlottesville. And I know that this session of the legislature changed what they call the proffer rules for some part of the state, or maybe all of the state, I'm not sure. But today's newspaper here in Charlottesville said that the proffer rules have been changed to allow a broader discussion between developers and local governments on the costs associated with the expansion of development and how and what can be included in those, quote, proffers. I think many people don't understand what that means. And I wonder if you gentlemen, I know Senator Deeds was quoted in the newspaper on this matter, as to what are the proffers that are now allowed here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and are they statewide or are they organized by community, or how shall we interpret that?
And I was quoted, and I will do the best I can. I'm probably not the best person to describe this. A proffer is if a developer wants to build a housing development, a proffer is basically what he pays the community, pays the board of supervisors or to build the infrastructure to support the housing development. A couple of years ago, the law was changed to say that if what is being built is not on the site of the development, then it's that's an unreasonable proffer, and it's not going to be upheld. And so I voted against that. I voted against that because I thought it froze discussions between localities and developers. This year, some legislation came in, and it was developed outside of the General Assembly's session, and I voted against it, but it partially undid that, and I think that part of it is good. It allows localities and developers to have more conversations, and the proffer potentially takes burden off of taxpayers because the infrastructure is paid for through the proffer instead of through increased property taxes, and that's not a bad thing. But it came up in such a way that I just wasn't comfortable voting for it, and so I didn't. Maybe Steve or David.
And usually these things come up in the context of something that's not a vested right that's in the zoning. In other words, usually somebody wants to do some, a developer wants to do something that's different than what the zoning allows, either more density or different kind of road pattern and such. And that opens up that conversation. And what was happening in Northern Virginia was that governments were, in the developer's view, extracting more than what was justified by the number of houses you were going to put on the site. And that led to the law of a couple years ago, which essentially removed the proffer system from operation. This new law opens up conversations so that developers and governments can have the discussion about if there's going to be something that's unique, that's a little bit different than the zoning, what will the developer give in the form of payments that will help support the school system or support the road network, et cetera. So I think it's going to open up that discussion. The question has always been, how do you quantify the impact? And there are lots of different models for how you do that, but there's not always consensus of how you do that. This is going to be ongoing. Every year we get a proffer bills like this, and we're always tweaking it, trying to make sure that it's fair to the locality in the sense of them getting their costs for other kinds of infrastructure, and fair to the people who own land, who want to develop the land that they have a right to develop under the law. I don't know if there's ever going to be a solution everybody agrees to all the time.
I think to follow up on what David and Kriya said, I think the General Assembly has been moving towards promoting more discussion with the localities and developers and allowing them to start working through those problems earlier rather than later in the process, because that's beneficial for both the developer and the locality. There are a lot of unintended consequences if that doesn't occur. I had legislation, and both these gentlemen voted for, that the county brought forward a couple years ago for developments in the urban ring where roadways and alleyways were developed in certain developments that fire trucks couldn't even basically come into the development or back around, which is a public safety issue. So we had to have legislation to allow the county police force to basically ticket and to penalize people who were blocking in developments these areas so that the public safety officials couldn't get in to actually come in for an emergency related to either fire or, you know, public safety issue or rescue squad and the like. But that's a good example of an unintended consequence, because that discussion didn't occur in the front end as opposed to the back end from the standpoint of a proffer would have really helped with that, because the road could have been wider, there could have been some additional requirements. And I think the county is trying to avoid that in the future, but that's why those discussions, I think, are important. The other issue is an affordability of housing again, because when you put additional requirements, there's got to be a balance, because somebody's going to pay for that. And if the developer's paying for that, you can believe that they're not going to just absorb that cost. That cost is going to be, you know, put into the actual structures that are built, the roadways, all those kinds of things, whether it's a development or association. And then whoever's purchasing those properties is going to pay.
Yeah, and just to build on this, this is a huge issue in Albemarle County, a huge issue in Charlottesville. And one of the reasons why I like people who have local government experience to be elected to the House of Delegates and the Senate is because they have a background in understanding these issues, because they're incredibly complex. You know, in local government, if somebody comes to you and they want to do a project that's different than what the zoning allows, they have to get a special use permit. And that special use permit opens up a public process that allows people to come in and say either they like it or they don't. And in many cases, they don't like the special use permit because it might have more density. So you deny the special use permit, and what happens is they build something on right by right that looks terrible. So that and only people with local government experience can understand that dynamic, such that when we start messing around with telling localities what to do, we're not making a big mistake. Because a lot of people, General Assembly, don't have local government experience.
They don't. And to your point, a whole lot of this discussion is driven by Loudoun County. Loudoun County is probably the only part
and
of
Prince Virginia, William now.
Yeah, yeah. Loudoun, Prince William that don't keep up with the GPS at all. You can run into a housing development that wasn't there 2 weeks ago. You know, development occurs so fast, and there were several iterations of this bill, these bills that did involve just those planning districts, Northern Virginia. But I think what passed affects all of us.
Yeah, I just want to ask a quick question about health insurance. We have a lot of problems in Virginia with it because there's a lot of people that are uninsured. And making the marketplace more competitive, you know, and opening up to attract more insurance companies, you know, to come along and put plans in place. I know that's controversial because everybody wants to have a low insurance price and they want to have all 100% coverage in it. So obviously the insurance companies want to make money at the same time. But can you just say a few more words about the state of where we are in Virginia, about what are we going to do to expand in a general way, lower health care costs, but expand insurance at affordable rates?
That's a big question. One of the things David and I worked on together this year was legislation to help understand how the rates are set. Because what we saw last year is no place in the country and saw a bigger increase in the marketplace than the unsubsidized insurance hold, people that paid for insurance that weren't subsidized that were in the Charlottesville marketplace. You saw the biggest increases in the country right here in the beginning of the fall of 2017. Now, that's gone down. But we had bills to basically change the definition of small business to ensure one-person businesses could get into that insurance marketplace to reduce their costs. We had bills to require the Bureau of Insurance to take a better look at how the rates are set and to provide the public more information, because, you know, more information might mean that if people know you're watching, there might be a little more clarity in the way the rates are set. Last year we expanded Medicaid. So we brought low-cost insurance basically up to 400,000 more Virginians that weren't covered at all. So, but a whole lot of the issues that we are dealing with aren't issues that we're able to deal with ourselves. You know, there are issues that are bigger than just Virginia. And some of the issues you address in terms of how we provide more low-cost care to more people are issues that affect many states. I wish I had all the answers to that, and I don't.
You know, it's interesting. You know, we're part-time legislators. You know, we don't have the ability or the time to look as much as we should, right? Well, one of the things we did find when we were looking at these bills is that the Bureau of Insurance they don't have a strict regulatory approval of rates, but they do have in their regulations a number of things where they can be much more zealous in protecting the interests of consumers. These were in their regulations. They are not in the code, and the Bureau of Insurance was not utilizing them. So the bill, one of the bills we had, is to put those regulations in the code, and not only that, but because we've spent so much time with the Bureau of Insurance, we got their attention. And you watch, I think they're going to be a lot more zealous in trying to protect consumers with the next round of filings on health insurance costs. One of the dilemmas that we all have is that it has to do with how the market works, right? If you have sick people and they're all in the marketplace, the rates are going to be high. The rationale for ACA is you put both the sick people and the relatively healthy people together, and that drew down the rates. But some of these so-called skinny plans have the potential to help the healthy people, which people want to have help, right? You get the healthy people, and they can buy these plans that don't offer the widest array of benefits, and naturally their costs are going to be lower. But when you pull them out of the pool, what happens to the rest of the pool? The prices go up. So trying to balance this is not easy. And I don't, you know, it's going to take a long time to remedy. I think long term we're probably looking at some kind of reinsurance program that allows the state to help subsidize and buy down the rates. But that is very, very expensive. And I don't think taxpayers have the appetite for that right now. And Bonnie, I was going to say, I have to go with a client a little bit. So if I'm not offended by your question. Yeah. That's not why I'm walking.
Let me give a contrarian view. One of the things the federal government could help states with is if you want to see some competition across state lines where you get companies that want to provide in a bigger footprint insurance, especially for small businesses, that would be helpful and I think would help bring the costs down. But the direction we're heading in this country is not to provide you additional choices, whether it's at the state or the federal level, but to tell you what you're going to get in health insurance. And I think that's just the direction we're heading. I don't agree with that viewpoint. I didn't support Medicaid expansion because of the cost we're going to see related to the state budget, which means we have less for other areas like education and the like, and it provides less choice. But that's not what occurred, so we're, you know, firmly planted in that. But what's going to happen is, I think in this country, you're going to have a government-run health insurance or health plan because we're not going to have any choices. I think you're going to see more and more health insurance companies go out of business, and I think the government's going to take over more and more. Now, the danger with that is, unless we can run it better than they do in Europe and some of these other countries, is you have to wait longer. You don't have choice where you can go for practices and the like. You're basically directed to where you will and you won't go. But, you know, maybe we can do it better. Maybe we can provide additional choices. But unless the federal government opens up that competition, I don't really think you're going to get some prices really come down. At least in my estimation, I've seen this and been involved in it, at least from the standpoint of the state-run system, for over 20 years now. And we just see costs keep going up. They never go down, and it consumes more and more of the state budget.
And I agree with that, but I want to make a point about Medicaid. Medicaid, you know, is federally mandated, but it's managed by the states. 70% of the Medicaid dollars in Virginia go to about 29% of the recipients. They're people that live in nursing homes. People that live in nursing homes that are on disability or are elderly. Medicaid was never intended to cover that population. So we have to be honest about it. We redefined Medicaid. We expanded it many times before we expanded it to 400,000 poor people last year. We expanded it many times, and the cost has exploded. But the cost has nothing to do with the expansion of last year. The cost explosion has to do with the aging of our population and our failure as a society to do long-term, to do planning for long-term care.
ERA, in addition to whatever concrete effects it may have on people's lives, it has tremendous symbolic importance to me and to a lot of other people, and it's a little bit dispiriting to know that I live in a state that refuses to vote for equal rights. Comments?
Well, I think you have to look at what is out there, and I realize it's symbolic, and I think when I talk to many women constituents especially, it is a symbolic gesture. But that's what it would be, in my estimation, is a gesture, in that the time frame from the standpoint of that constitutional amendment, and there's a big debate going on whether it has or it hasn't expired, but in the reading and the looking back at history related to other constitutional amendments, I believe that the time frame has expired. What would be the best way, again, and I think, again, as Cree said, you know, sometimes we've got to just kind of back up and just, you know, look at this not from an emotional standpoint, but look at it from a factual standpoint. If it has expired or if it hasn't, the best way to go forward would be to have another constitutional amendment introduced that accomplishes what you're trying to do and try to maybe address some of the other issues that I'm not an attorney, so I'm not an expert from the standpoint of, you know, whether it does or it doesn't open up some unintended consequences. Maybe those things could be looked at by some of the legal scholars, but then have it reintroduced and then given to the states without the kind of the shadow of whether the time frame has passed or not. And I think that'd be the most fair way to move forward. And then you have a clear and you know, direction from the standpoint of moving forward, both from the Congress and the states, with an equal rights amendment.
You know, one of the most recently adopted constitutional amendments was actually proposed in like 1790 as part of the Bill of Rights. And it says that Congress, a congressional pay increase doesn't go into effect until after the next election. So the argument, the debate really is whether or not Congress had the ability or had the authority to impose a limitation on approving the amendment. You know, and I think it would have more than symbolic effect. Here's the reality. Women make a lot less than men for doing the same kind of jobs. The Equal Rights Amendment would give them a cause of action to enforce their right to earn the same amount of money that a man makes. And, you know, we passed it in the Senate several times. We passed it again this year. We had bipartisan majorities that passed it. And it's gotten hung up in the House. But I'm hopeful that, and there only needs to be one more state that passes it. So if we do it, we have the opportunity to be the state that passes it. But hopefully somebody will pass it before we go back into session.
Mine's an immediate follow-on to that. Question for you. What were the underlying causes? You said, we've got unintentional consequences, Steve. My wife talked with, I think, you and also Rob Bell about this and got no satisfactory explanation as to why the House should not pass the amendment.
Well, I just gave you one.
Well, yeah, but let's. That to me is a minor thing. If you would consider it only as symbolic, but they.
No, I said whether you consider it symbolic or not. I was talking about the time frame, and that's increased right. There's a constitutional amendment that didn't have any limitations on it by the Congress. No time frame was set. That's where the debate, again, from the time frame stands. But there have been other constitutional amendments that were adopted that had a time frame given and said it has to be adopted by states before it would take effect or not.
How many failed because of a time?
I'd have to go back and look. I can't recall, but there.
I don't remember any having been. I'm not as good. Huh, Dave? You're the historian. Zero. There's a historian telling me that. Thank you for being here. But my point is really, what other underlying reasons?
Well, I can tell you one of the problems is some of the religious groups are concerned about what it would allow or not allow from the standpoint of their religious beliefs. And it's not just the Christian belief, but there's other religious beliefs too, and I'm not sure exactly what all those are. I've just heard that's, you know, one of those things. The other thing is Title IX and some other things related to protections for small and women-owned businesses. You know, whether it would do away with any of those incentives. For instance, we have a whole department of Department of Small Business and Supplier Diversity in Virginia that works on SWAM, basically women-owned businesses, and provides additional incentives. There's some discussion about whether that would all go away if the Equal Rights Amendment was passed. So there's the unintended consequences. Title IX, obviously making sure that women's sports have the same opportunities as male sports in colleges and high school and the like. So those are some of the things specifically that probably need to be tweaked in the original language. The language is pretty broad, when it was in, but it was written, you know, what, 30, 40 years ago.
Okay, so. I'm going to have to end our discussion 12 minutes early because we're losing our speakers. So I would just like to say thank you very much for serving. And thank you very much for your years of showing up for these events. So thank you very much for coming.